Welcome to Living Life on Purpose on the Living Well Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, Suzanne Streisauer, and I'm a holistic life and career coach. And I've spent decades expanding my own consciousness, and I've found lots of resources for the body, mind, and spirit that I think you're going to love. On Living Life on Purpose, I'm going to be introducing you to many authors and experts on a wide variety of topics, including sustainability, spirituality, optimal health and well-being, and inspirational authors, musicians, and entertainers. We're going to give you new insights and possibilities to enhance and enrich your life. Be inspired for life and join me today on Living Life on Purpose. Welcome to the show today. I'm so excited to have this special segment of Living Life on Purpose. This is not my normal Monday show, and it's because we have a special guest in town, and I wanted to promote her and also to promote her work more globally. And I also find it really interesting that in this last month, I've had a musician from Lebanon, a person speaking about radio, and then tonight I'm going to have, or today I'm going to have a woman speaking about creativity as a songwriter and also singer-songwriter, creative person, poet, and also someone who's been featured in a documentary and helped make a documentary on mental health and illness. And so what an interesting conglomeration. So that's where we're going to go today. But in the meantime, I want to tell you a little bit about Living Life on Purpose and about myself and the services that I offer, and then we're going to jump right into this really interesting and important interview for today. So I've been doing the show now for about 5 years, actually a little more than 5 years, and so every week I get the privilege of interviewing someone who's inspirational on the planet doing something fabulous. And so today's segment is like a special segment. It's a bonus segment. Just because Meg happens to be in town this week for this premiere and letting everybody know about this movie and make a contribution to everybody else's life and understanding about what kind of happens for people. And so, you know, needless to say, she's living her purpose, so I'm happy to have her on the show. And so if you're interested in learning more about your purpose and getting more in touch with your purpose, I'm a life purpose expert and life purpose coach, and I help people do that every day. And I've got a new service now that I offer called Get Your Life and Career Profile Done. So I help you in 90 minutes really figure that out. I have a streamlined process, and if you're interested, you can go to 111lifepurpose.com. Again, that's 111lifepurpose.com. And you can do that on your own with my workbook. It's an award-winning workbook where I walk you through the steps, or like I say, you can do it with me in 90 minutes. And also on that page, you can also find my free guidebook, 7 Steps to Living a More Purposeful Life, where I actually give you a few assessments and walk you through that. It's 32 pages and a simple thing to complete, but it'll give you a lot of insights about where you are in your life and what's happening for you. So like I said, today is a rare Thursday show, and so I wanted to just, you know, follow at least a few of the things that I do when I do my weekly show, and one is that I have the cosmic impacts for today. And so today is an interesting day. It's quiet, but because Venus is in retrograde, and part of her circle is that she cycled going back and forth, and since she's in retrograde now, she's actually reconnecting with Uranus. And my astrologer, who I love, Michael Lennox, says that when that happens in this particular aspect, which he calls the great eliminator, that it means that we're going to be releasing things and letting go of the past and shifting things into something more positive that's more in alignment with our future. So if you're feeling a little out of sorts today and this last period of time has also been sort of tough and stressful for you, just know that it may be something bigger than yourself where the planetary aspects are actually kind of colluding to make us move in one direction or another. Some people are having a really great time with this. Some people are having a tough time with this. So just be gentle with yourself and know that there are a lot of other cosmic things happening, and also that there's something called Wave X, which is happening and building. It's actually cosmic energy influences that are coming in from outside of our solar system that are actually beginning to be well documented, remarkably enough. And so you can find Wave X. And I've also put a lot of that information on the Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page. So if you're interested, go to Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page, and I will also put up all the different links to the people and places and things that I've mentioned on the show today. So without further ado, I want to go and start in on this topic. And it's really interesting to me because Creativity is something that I love, and in years past, I actually was the child advocate for the Mental Health Commission of my county at the time, and was very aware of the issues of the mentally ill and how they were trying to be proactive, trying to get services, trying to be mainstreamed in society, and just, you know, the various things that went on. So it's going to be really interesting to me today to hear how our guest, with her creativity and also her perseverance and energy, has sort of moved through all these different circles to be a very successful artist in her own right and musician. So my guest today is Meg Hutchinson, and she is a native of Massachusetts. She's done 8 albums, and including Beyond That, that was released in 2013. She's also a poet, and she wrote a book of poetry called The Morning I Was Born, A Month in Poems. And I hope we'll have her read a poem or two along the way as we do that. And she's also done a few other albums, The Living Side, Beyond That. And what we're going to really be talking about today is her battle with mental illness, how she's surmounted that. And then she's now the subject of a documentary called Pack Up Your Sorrows. And so that's a remarkable movie. And also, I was reading in her bio and press material something that I found really interesting. And that was, I believe that the role of an artist is to keep braving that deep inner work, to keep growing, Meg says. Creativity should be a method for transformation. This takes time. It takes quiet. I have spent a good deal of time, the last 3 years, walking in the woods with my dog, sitting on the rocks beside my favorite lake, watching the sky go dark, learning a meditation and a yoga practice. So with that, welcome to the show today, Meg.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be on.
So let's just start at the beginning. One of the things that I always ask my guests is, you know, to just sort of give us a little frame of reference about who you are. And so as I was reading information about you, you actually started playing the guitar when you were 7 years old. And I'm just wondering what that was like. I mean, that guitar must have been just about the same size you were at that time.
It's true. I was quite young when I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I was very fortunate when I was about 8 or 9, I inherited my grandmother's guitar. It was a 1957 Martin guitar, and my uncle Hutch sent it to me. And I felt like there was something, this connection with my, you know, ancestors. And this, it went up a notch from just wanting to be a musician to finding a way to connect with my grandparents. And it felt like a huge honor and something I needed to then become worthy of. So I started...
Did you come from a musical family, Meg, where obviously your grandparents were, and obviously they had some good taste because Martins are highly esteemed guitars, but in your immediate family, was there a lot of creativity as well?
I come from a family on both sides of writers. So I have a lot of word people in my extended family. And my paternal grandmother had the Martin guitar, and she taught guitar lessons and sang. So the music really came from her side, but everywhere I turn in my family, we have writers, and I really grew up with this feeling that words were the currency in our family. We weren't expected to grow up and make a lot of money and, you know, do well in business. It was all about how can you say something in a fresh way. Poetry and songwriting were really valued in my family, and that's something, you know, that was a huge blessing, especially as a young kid to be, you know, told that that was something worthwhile to pursue.
That's fantastic, and it is really rare. So in that environment, when you were, you know, as a young child, and it's ironic because the man I interviewed last week, he started out in radio as a teenager, and he's in radio, you know, almost 40 years later. So when you started playing the guitar, what was that resonance for you that, oh, I've found my purpose, oh, this is the love of my life, oh, this is a passion, I want to do this forever? What was that sort of path process like for you?
It was the most interesting feeling of familiarity. I felt like I was coming home to something that I already knew. And I remember the first time I wrote an original song was in 8th grade. And it was a song about apartheid in South Africa. I did it for a geography project in school. And I remember I played it at the school talent show. And I just remember being up there on stage, you know, in front of a whole auditorium and singing the song. And I walked off stage and I burst out crying. And I remember my fellow eighth grade friends, you know, patting me on the back and saying, "Why are you crying? You did a good job." And I was crying because I had come home. I knew where I belonged. And it was such an amazing feeling as an eighth grader to just know this is what I want to do. And I remember walking out into the schoolyard and it was snowing. And I was swinging my guitar case in one hand and just looking up the snowflakes and going, "Wow, you know, I've found my place." And that's, you know, such a blessing as a young girl to feel like, you know, I knew where I fit in the world and what I loved. And that became...
And it's remarkable. Yeah, that's really remarkable because most people don't find that on a good day, and yet you did that in eighth grade, and it sounds like you were in a really supportive environment besides that to make everything happen and flourish.
I was. And, of course, there were a number of years where I was very distracted as a teenager in high school and put a lot of my energy into sports instead of music. But it came back in my late teens. And as I began to wrestle with my first depression, where I didn't understand what was happening to me, music became medicine. And that was a whole new way to connect with it. And it carried me through 9 years of living with a mood disorder that I didn't understand yet and didn't recognize.
Wow. Now, did you always, so you're a folk singer and folk musician from what I read, and kind of, for my money, a sort of a ballady folk singer. And I love that kind of music because I think it so taps into the heart and the soul of people because it's so real and authentic. You mentioned the apartheid original song about, you know, what happened in South Africa. Did all of your songs have a message, Meg?
Definitely. Songwriting wasn't something that I ever did to kind of be clever. It never came from an intellectual place. It came from a deep feeling place. It came from trying to make sense of something that was puzzling me or concerning me. And for many years, that became really an effort to solve a mystery at the center of my life. It was the mystery of what's happening to me. You know, what's going on in here that's making my life get harder and harder. And the music was this way to try to investigate and get to the center of that. So the songs were always, you know, very much having a mission for me. They were doing work in my life. They weren't just entertainment.
So walk us through that process, because I think that's fascinating. And I think that's a great kind of really unique way for people and perhaps my listeners to kind of look at their lives with fresh eyes. So when you walk us through the process, so when there was something going on in your life, how did you start trying to process that music? How you tried to put the lyrics together, or how you tried to solve the lyrics within that? How did that work for you?
So each song is born in a slightly different way. There's no formula for me, but generally you get a sense for something. For me, it's usually two things that I feel are connected, but I'm not sure how. So maybe it's an image I've seen, for example, an old apple tree along a path that's grown around barbed wire. And I see that image and I take this kind of mental snapshot and I go, that is a metaphor. That is an image that I want to bring home to my dark room. And then I go home and I say, what does this image mean to me? And I go, oh, this is an image about recovery. This is an image about healing. And then, you know, the song unfolds as a result of kind of mapping that connection. And over, I felt like my job was really like being a photographer. It was about being awake and taking that mental photograph whenever I saw an image that really struck me, and then letting that develop, bringing that to the creative dark room and finding out what about that image had struck me and what it meant. So I think for me, it was about taking the images first and then bringing them home and figuring out what they mean, instead of just sitting there trying to come up with good metaphors for sadness or loneliness or joy. It's always started out in the world. It starts by being an observer, you know, much more like being a photographer and being open to that. Learning how to watch, learning how to listen is a huge part of being an artist, I think, in any medium.
You know, that's fascinating. So as you're talking, I'm thinking about, you know, the old adage, you know, when a book falls off of a shelf for you, you're probably meant to read that. So when you're out in nature, like you were just talking about that apple tree and the barbed wire, does all of a sudden that image just kind of come and grip you, just kind of like a book falling off the shelf, like, oh, okay, good, I get it. And then you know that that's how you're going to be working with that?
There's a deep resonance. I don't think there's an intellectual understanding yet of why. There's just this heart connection, and I'm just gathering those images, and I'm bringing them home and putting them into my journals. And sometimes the songs come right away. You know, I've had songs, one time on a hike, an entire song came to me, and I even heard the music. Those are miraculous, and they're few and far between. Generally, it's a much slower process. There's kind of this feeling of the song maturing and the pieces coming together, and you can't force it, I've found. You have to kind of let it simmer, and slowly you figure out, you know, once you know what the chorus is, then you've found the center of the wheel, and then you can start making these verses like spokes, you know. But if you find the kernel of the message of the song, that's when I always know, okay, it's within my grasp. But, you know, if you don't find that center, there are a lot of songs that just dwindle, you know, that don't make it all the way to harvesting. But it really, the role, I think, of the artist is that awakeness, that awareness, finding that silence and finding that ability to observe in a very open-minded way.
You know, I had an artist friend who was a fine artist, a painter, and I remember, you know, watching him watch the world. And I always would say to him, you know, I want to get inside of your head because you look at the world in some kind of way different than how I know the world. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like, again, what you're saying is that there's a different attunement that you artist people have that allows you to go deeper. And I think part of it is just the rest of us aren't as quiet as we need to be or sensitive or letting that sensitivity be part of our, you know, trade in the way that you are in our creative process. But just how you guys do that is remarkable to me.
And I think you use such a good word. I mean, it really is sensitivity in both the most positive way you can imagine, but also in a painful way. I mean, I find among many of my artist friends that we are deeply sensitive beings, and that's partly why the world enters us so deeply. I think things really, the pain and the joy of the world comes in very directly when you have that sensitivity. And so it means you feel everything very deeply, and that compels you to want to make something out of that richness. But it's also sometimes really, to be honest, a painful way to live because you don't have as many walls. And so things really enter you, but at the same time, there's so many moments where the joy, especially for me, that joy and the beauty of the natural world goes right into my heart and has always been a deep part of my creative process.
So talking about that, you know, the not so kind of comfortable part of your life, because you've been really open and candid with that. So in your materials that I was reading, you actually discovered you had a mental illness, and I don't even know if that's the right word, the politically correct way to say that anymore, when you were a teenager. So what happened, Meg? What was that sort of at some level unfortunate, another level fortunate, you know, because that gift of sensitivity sometimes can be wrapped up in, you know, more painful things. What was the understanding or the symptoms like that first led you to understanding you had something wrong?
So it actually took me 9 years to understand. I had my first major depression when I was 19, but I didn't recognize it. And I went on to struggle privately for 9 more years. I was 28 years old when I finally hit rock bottom and had such a breakdown that my brain could no longer function. And I had no choice but to get help at that point. And then it's been 9 years since of healing and recovery and awareness and repairing that brain. And so I'm kind of, it's this perfect balance, 9 years before, 9 years after. But one of the things that's really surprising is how long it took me to recognize it. And I realize as I read more and more that that's true for many people. And it comes partly from a lack of education. We don't actually know when we're feeling, you know, I'd always thought depression was extreme sadness. So when my first depression hit and I wasn't sad, I was just exhausted, foggy-brained, unable to finish my schoolwork, you know, had lost my enthusiasm. I didn't translate that as depression at the time. I just thought there was something, you know, maybe I had mono, maybe something else was happening. And on top of it, I was a very willful, classic overachiever. And I thought at the time that depression happened to weak people. And I knew I was a willful, strong person. So, you know, surely it wasn't depression. Depression wouldn't, you know, hit someone like me. I was too strong for that. And that was such a misunderstanding, but a common one, you know. So being a perfectionist and being a very private person, I continued to hide it. And the symptoms, the highs got higher, the lows got lower. And with bipolar disorder, it's confusing because each time you reach a high, you think the worst is behind you. And you think, now I'm okay. I don't need to get help. I feel better than I've ever felt, you know. That must have been some, like, awkward growing up stage, and now I'm okay. And so in many ways, bipolar can be even more frustrating because you don't see the pattern for a long time. When you're down inside of it, you don't have that perspective. But I'm really glad you raised this question of what should we call it. It is still being called mental illness, but I prefer to think of these as illnesses of the brain. I don't believe that the entire mind is sick. And that's one of the things that's been pivotal in my healing, is to see that the mind is actually my ally in dealing with a brain that has some faulty wiring.
So do you think it's faulty wiring? I know that, and we're going to talk about your movie, but do you think that some of that faulty wiring is actually biochemical in nature? And did your family, anybody but you, suffer with this? Or were you the first one who kind of this happened to in your family?
Yeah, we do see a family history of it. And we also, you know, without a doubt, when it was happening to me, it was such a biological experience. And I had always thought that somehow mental illness was something you could just overcome through enough poetry, enough nature walks, enough kale. Like, surely it's more of an existential problem. But when I was experiencing it, it was so absolutely a biological illness. And the fact that
talk about that, Meg, because I think, you know, if anything, I want you're a poster child for legitimizing, let's say, brain dysfunction, which then creates some kind of disorder, so that people can kind of demystify depression and what that means. What were the original symptoms that you had that you couldn't name that were part of what you called depression for yourself?
So it might be helpful to talk about one of the final depression, because it just exaggerates some of those qualities so you can see them really clearly. But there's disorientation. I mean, it felt like early Alzheimer's. I would get lost in my own neighborhood. This is right before my final breakdown. I would have trouble. I was supposed to be packing my suitcase for a trip, and I couldn't make decisions about anything. That whole ability for the brain to compare articles of clothing, decide, remember what season it is, figure out how many things you need to pack for 2 weeks. Those abilities of my brain went out the window. I went downstairs to the laundry room and I looked at the knobs on the washing machine and I didn't know what they meant. So that is a very clear brain disorder at that point. It's not, you know, a feeling of, oh my gosh, I'm sad. It's a feeling of my brain isn't working. It's very confusing. And also my sleep pattern got completely disrupted. So I started to have terrible insomnia. And, you know, so when I was 19, you know, backing up 9 years before that, it really just felt like exhaustion. It felt like suddenly it was really hard to get out of bed. It was hard to fall asleep. It was hard to focus on my schoolwork. It just felt like fog, you know, it felt like a really heavy fog in my brain. And having always been a super enthusiastic kid, I couldn't believe that I wasn't interested in getting up in the morning, and I would rather lie in bed and watch movies for 5 hours at a time. Suddenly things seemed kind of pointless, and suddenly I had these kind of passive wishes that I would disappear. It wasn't actively suicidal behavior at that age, but it was this wish that I would just kind of quietly disappear. It seemed impossible to have the energy to get up every morning for the rest of my life.
So in that process, did you articulate that to your family, or were you living at home? How was your environment, the people around you, dealing with that with you? And it could have just been in school. What was the response to people to you?
So I was sharing an apartment with my older sister at the time, and she did at one point use the word depression, and I was deeply insulted. I actually felt like that was an attack on my character. I felt like it meant that I was weak, and I was sure that it wasn't depression. I was very defiant. And in the following years, I lived alone, and then I moved to Boston where nobody knew me. And as I look back, I was actually structuring a life where I could hide these symptoms more and more from people. And you begin to isolate. I mean, depression creates this biological need to isolate. And I really set up a life where my friends kind of thought it was just me being an artist when I would disappear, you know, for months at a time. They just thought, oh, Meg's being creative. You know, she always comes back. So I was amazed at how much I kept from my family. And it was also because my family culture did not accept these illnesses or mainstream medicine until we all had to. So if I, you know, told them I was feeling a little off, you know, they would just say, oh, you know, write another song and go on another
hike. It'll all be good again. Yep.
It'll be fine. You know, here's a whole bunch of, you know, positive thinking quotes. And that family culture becomes a real hurdle in getting treatment because, you know, if you're told, oh, we don't need therapy in our family, you kind of internalize that and you think, oh, I'm going to be disappointing my parents just to get a therapist. You know,
right.
So that's a dangerous situation, you know, that a loving family can still create a culture where, you know, you don't feel okay about getting help. That's very scary.
Now, did you ever have to, so what was your process? Did you wind up getting into therapy? Where did you go? And then did you wind up having to be on medication for it? Or how did you kind of help yourself get to a place where you felt okay with where you're at?
So I was touring in Europe. My music career had really taken off, which was great, but it was a lifestyle that is totally dangerous when you're living with an untreated mood disorder because you're in different time zones, and I was drinking a lot of beer and smoking pot with all these musicians. It was like a total recipe for a breakdown. But I was in Europe for 10 days on this whirlwind tour in the spring of 2006 and came home. I'd been high as a kite for 4 months, and I crashed, and I crashed harder than I ever had. And that's when my brain stopped working to the point where I really couldn't take care of myself. I couldn't sleep for even an hour. And I finally called my mom, and it was the hardest phone call I've ever made. I just said, my brain is not working. You know, I need to come home. I need help. And it was a long process, but I was hospitalized, and eventually I was in and out of the hospital, and finally, you know, over the course of 21 days of inpatient, you know, I was properly diagnosed right in the beginning, but it took a while for the medications to get to the right level, and it was frustrating. There's a lot of trial and error with medicine. And psychiatric medicine is, you know, still very far behind.
It's in its infancy, for sure.
It is, and that can be very frustrating when you're in that kind of agony, and your brain is that broken. It's very hard to just kind of sit and wait and hope that something's going to work. And it did. Luckily, it did. And, you know, it was about 7 weeks of really acute illness that summer. And I've been on medication ever since, and it's been a process of, as you can imagine, you come out of the hospital way over medicated, and slowly you know, balance out the rest of your life and can start to go down on those medications to what you just, you know, the bare minimum of what you need to keep that brain functioning properly. And I've tested those boundaries. You know, I'm still a hippie, you know, the child of two hippies. I'm still, you know, I went through a phase where I went, oh, that was a perfect storm. I don't need medication. And tried to taper down, and lo and behold, you know, hit another depression and went, okay, I do need this help. You know, I need this help, but it's not where the healing has come from.
Interesting. So, you know, it's interesting because when I was in graduate school way back when, we were given a diagnosis to kind of live with for a period of time. And mine was depression. Mm-hmm. And I can remember feeling that, feeling like no way out, like at the bottom of a lake looking up and the water just kind of gurgling around me, meaning having bubbles, you know, but not really knowing even what to do with that. And I was like, oh, my God, you know, and then I was reading some books, you know, that we had as part of that class, one by William Styron. And, and then there was another one by a psychiatrist in San Diego who is very bipolar. And she kind of did the cycles of exactly what you're talking about. And Kay Redfield, and I forget what her last name is.
Yeah, she's in our film, Kay Redfield Jameson.
Yep, yep.
She plays a large role in our film.
Yes, yeah, she went and she wrote a fabulous book on her experience with being a bipolar and what that meant, and just like what you're talking about, where it's those huge dramatic swings, and that they, you know, they can really throw you in very dynamic ways, in really polarized ways, I guess is the best way to say that. So it's interesting to hear you talk about that experience. So when you went and now, so during this time when you were manic, you were on your tour, right? And then when you came back, you crashed and you went to the depression side of that, which is, for people listening, how they get the name bipolar, is you go from one extreme to the other. So then all of a sudden when you crash, you get hospitalized, and then you start to say, I want to normalize things. Is that how that went? You kind of said, you know what, I don't want this swing anymore. I want to make this more evened out in my life. Is that kind of where you went with this?
So what happened is I actually fell into a mixed state, which is where you're manic and depressed simultaneously. So if you can imagine, it's like two storm fronts colliding, and my body's catatonically depressed and my brain is on fire, literally just racing and racing. It's a terrifying place to be. And I've never been that scared in my life and that disoriented and that frightened and acutely suicidal. So when you go through that kind of agony, you know, my response is I never want to feel that way again. Ever. It's so frightening.
So you're going to keep yourself away from that edge, period.
Absolutely. There's nothing romantic about it. You know, when it's that scary and that life-threatening, and you look at the numbers and one in four or one in five people with bipolar disorder, you know, die by suicide, that is not something I want to take my chances with. And, you know, so one thing I want to touch on just to back up a little bit is I'm very aware of how we misuse the term. We say someone is bipolar, and I always like to say someone has bipolar. It's something, when we used to say manic depression, we couldn't say, I'm manic depression. But when we changed this term to bipolar, I hear a lot of people in the media and individuals saying, yeah, she's bipolar, I'm bipolar. That I have a real issue with because we're then identifying as an illness instead of a person dealing with an illness. And something I always like to point out, especially talking to young people, you know, we are not the illness. This is, you know, just like anything, diabetes, it's something we have to treat and deal with, but it's not our identity.
Great point. Now, I was reading, again, in your material that there were lots of really kind of fun and rich aspects to yourself, and one of them is spirituality. And so one of the things, you know, because I do a lot of spiritual work and hypnotherapy and all sorts of things, so when something like that happens, I always kind of ask the divine, if there's a root cause, like why should Meg have to be afflicted by this? So did you, from a spiritual perspective, ever kind of question that, and did you come up with an answer for yourself?
That's interesting. I was very fortunate 3 years into my recovery to meet a Tibetan Lama, and he's the Harvard Buddhist chaplain, Lama Mi'kmaq, and he was just walking on a path by my house all the time. So I would pass him, and I was always interested in Buddhism, but I finally I had the chance to meet him, and I started studying at his center in Cambridge and have studied with him for 6 years, and that's been the greatest turning point as far as my healing and my understanding of my own mind. And of course, in Buddhism, you have, you know, these ideas of karma and suffering and the nature of suffering. And, you know, for me, the real takeaway is that suffering is something that touches every life. And the real question is, how do you take that suffering and turn it into something useful, instead of, you know, kind of living in that identity of, why did this happen to me? You know, feeling sorry for yourself. How do I take this pain and make it into something that can be of service in some way? And that's been the way I've made sense of it. Instead of seeing it as something that stopped my life as I knew it, I started to treat it like a doorway, you know, something that definitely changed the course of my life, but has become this very interesting doorway to a totally different and very rich and very fulfilling life. And all this advocacy work that feels like my true calling, you know, it's woven in with the music, but it feels like the way that I can be of service in the world. So that's how I've come to view it, you know, rather than wallowing and saying, why did this happen to me? You know, I've always, you know, been so good. How could this happen to me? You know, to just look at it like, this is an example of how these illnesses can happen to anyone. What can I do with this experience to turn it around?
Well, and the thing that's lovely about that is that at some deep level, you're really giving back. And I really feel that the only way we can really help other people is to have been in their shoes, to really have that level of empathy. And then when you're really high functioning, to be able to say, hey, I'm one of those people who has a bipolar disorder, and it's not, I'm a crazy person, and oh, by the way, I'm a musician, a songwriter, I've done poetry, you know, I've created a documentary. So clearly, there's nothing that's out of sync except that I have a brain disorder, and so I want you all to understand that this is not something that just, you know, they have, whoever that they is.
Exactly. You know, and it's not like I leapt into telling my story right away. I mean, I had to battle with all kinds of feelings after my breakdown, and plenty of shame and plenty of fear. And it was a very slow process of getting comfortable. And as people started to ask me to speak, and as I started to see that that was helpful and that people were grateful, then my confidence grew and I got more comfortable with it. But you're right. I mean, that's what we need to hear, are the individual stories, so that we can think of these illnesses without, you know, only hearing the horrible stories. You know, right now we just hear, the media covers the really frightening stories about mental illness. And really, 1 in 5 Americans are taking some kind of medication or dealing with some form of a psychiatric disorder. So the majority of us are leading ordinary lives. And if we share that story, we take away the stigma. We take away all of these misconceptions about these illnesses.
Well, I think that you're truly a gift to the world that you're doing this in this way. So let's talk about your albums, Meg, and, you know, 8 albums. So kind of walk us on the evolutionary journey of your albums, and then we're going to talk about your poetry, and then I want to spend some time on your documentary.
So I look at my trajectory as an artist, and it's so fascinating. So much of it is based around, like I mentioned before, trying to figure out what the heck is going on with me. What's happening in my life? What is this mystery? And so my early records, you know, my first studio record is called Against the Gray. And I look back now and I'm talking about against that grayness of depression. I didn't know it at the time, but that album is all about trying to figure out what this grayness is that's come across my life. And so there were a number of records in that early part that were really looking at that and kind of plumbing the depths and looking at all those things. And then the three albums after my breakdown have been albums of deep healing and hope and really writing songs to heal myself. And the most recent album beyond that is very true to its title. It's really not even about those themes anymore. It's really about the space that's happened after. And the last 3 or 4 years of my life have been deeply peaceful, deeply beautiful years. And I've given myself permission to really slow down, to really prioritize my health over any other career goals. And the reward in that has been joy, happiness, you know, peace of mind, and hours in the woods with my dog every day. So this last album feels like really kind of prayers even more than songs.
How cool is that? I wish I'd actually gotten a chance to get some of your music up, because normally I would have loaded some cuts and we would have played some music. So I want you to go to the Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page and we'll put some up, because I think it's important to hear those. So that's a great trajectory for the music. How about the book of poems? You know, what made you write The Morning I Was Born, A Month in Poems?
That actually started as a result of my mom inspiring me. She's written a poem every morning for about 12 years, and she had always been critical of herself. Her father was a famous editor, and, you know, she has memories of running around with Robert Frost trying to help him get his donkey back into the pasture. You know, if you have those kind of memories of famous people, you know, you get really judgmental. So she was very critical until she was in her late 50s. And then one day, you know, her three daughters were grown and she found herself alone at breakfast going, well, I'm going to write a poem. And that felt so good that she did it for 12 years. And she challenged me to try to write a poem every morning for the month of April. And so National Poetry Month in April, she now has a big mailing list of people that she'll send out a writing assignment every morning. And then people all over the country will write a poem. So that's what that book came from. I wrote a poem every morning in April, inspired by these poetry prompts that she sent, and decided it fit together in a collection.
Good. So is that book handy, by the way, Meg?
You know, when you mentioned it, I noticed I had one over on my table here, so, yeah.
Oh, good. So tell us give us the prompt, and then tell us the poem you wrote, if you can.
Oh,
remember.
I don't have any of the prompts in front of me.
Okay.
Don't recall, because it was several years ago, so.
Okay. Yeah, just read,
don't remember
read us,
those.
Read us a couple of poems that are particularly meaningful to you.
Sure. So here's one that's called Yesterday. And it's really, for me, about reclaiming the present moment. Yesterday, I met a woman once from India. I drank tea with her in an airport Hilton lobby. She told me of her awakening when she was 9 years old. One night, in bed beside her sisters, she realized she could remember yesterday. She burst into tears. The thought of yesterday had never even occurred to her. If there was one yesterday, there would be more. The weight of all the future yesterdays began to bear down on her slender frame. She wept in earnest and clutched at the wall all night long, heartbroken at this exile from the moment. Looking back down the pale street of my yesterdays, I also feel a terror sometimes. The days are piled high, a library ransacked by time. Misplaced, out of order, covers gone. Some have whole pages missing or torn. Others someone cruel has written on. And in one corner, yesterdays that were so long, I couldn't even finish them. I used to think I'd have to get the whole place in shape before I'd be given back today. It's not like that. You could spend a lifetime rearranging them. Better just to give them all away.
Oh, I love that. How beautiful.
Thank you. I'll share one more here. This is called Night Hike, And it's something I found myself doing more and more. The sky would just be so beautiful at sunset that I couldn't help but stay till the sun was all the way down, and then I'd find myself walking back to the car in pitch darkness. And it became this wonderful practice where I actually loved trying to navigate through the dark. And you'll see in the poem, it had deeper meaning for me. Night hike. You do not know the woods till you've wandered them at night. I go there at dusk so my eyes will adjust to the slowly dying light. I hug the lake when I practice this. I've learned to step my feet high, the dressage of navigating rocky paths. In this, I must resemble some awkward horse, half prance, half stumble. I never bring a light. I'd forget to see the forest. My friends do not approve of this. They mention coyotes and the psychopaths, the mother bear. They've never been out here. Felt the heat the stones hold long after the sun's gone down. Sat so quiet they could hear the hiss of bat wings. Watched the path grow luminous beneath their feet. I'm always startled when I reach the car. Looking back over my shoulder. The woods so black now. It seems impossible I've just come through. It's best to practice darkness a little each day. 1 year, it lasted months, and I wasn't ready.
Well, that says it all. That says it all. Well, that's a perfect lead into your movie. So talk about Pack Up Your Sorrows. Talk about how that movie came into being. Talk about the documentary. Just give us some information about Pack Up Your Sorrows.
So the film has just been a total gift, totally came out of the blue in many respects, and has been the most organic collaboration and the most fulfilling project. It started, I met the filmmakers probably 4 years ago. They were making a film about Club 47, which was a real center of folk music in Cambridge, in Harvard Square in the 60s. And they were charting that history, and then they had a section where they were talking about some of the contemporary artists that still play that club. And I was one of them, and I appeared for about 40 seconds in the film. But I got to meet them, and I liked them instantly. And they've been friends since they were college students, so they've been friends probably as long as I've been alive almost. And they have a great rapport. They're really fun to be around, Todd Quaite and Rob Stegman. So I found myself sitting in the trailer with them while they finished their filming and just chatting. And after that project wrapped, I wrote an email to them and said, you know, if you're ever doing another film and you want someone to, you know, be an assistant and go on coffee runs for you guys, you know, let me know. I've always loved film. And then we stayed in touch, and they made a film about Tom Rush. And they actually said, do you want to help us? And I was putting out my own record at the time, so I couldn't be the coffee girl. And then we started to really hone in on the fact that we had this common interest in the mental health story and started having conversations about it. And the project just unfolded very naturally. Todd Quaite and I started sending books back and forth and articles, and we had no set script going into it. We just knew we wanted to make a film that would inspire conversation and help to take away some of the stigma, some of the discrimination. And we wanted to tell a story that covered very large topics through a very intimate lens, through the personal story and my own experience with my family and with the illness, and with art and nature and all these things that I care about. So we started filming, and we went all over the country. We wrote letters to many of our heroes, some real groundbreaking scientists, authors, you know, historians, psychiatrists. And most of them said, yeah, well, we'd be happy to be in the film. And so the response was amazing. We got to fly around and interview all of these people about You know, everything from how meditation is changing the actual structure and function of the brain to, you know, how do we help more kids get the education they need around these illnesses in the schools. And so we spoke with Kay Redfield Jamison and Scott Stossel, who's the editor of The Atlantic, and neuroscientist Dr. Richard Davidson, and many more. And it was a dream project and really just a gift and something that we all really shared a vision for. So the project was very very easy to do, I think, because we had such a common goal. So I've never done such a big project that flowed so easily before.
Well, and the book trail, the cinematography of it was great, and I felt like the scenes where you were interviewing the experts, you know, there was sort of a compelling nature to those scenes in that clip, Meg, which was just really, you know, remarkable to see, you know, how honest and authentic they were with you. And obviously it was really short, but you could feel there was a definite connectedness, and they wanted to share whatever they could to make things be different and to facilitate the process. So at the end of the day, you called the movie Pack Up Your Sorrows. And what was the intent behind that title?
So when I was 8 years old, my dad gave me a cassette tape of Richard and Mimi Farina singing that old folk song, Pack Up Your Sorrows. And it impacted me so much. It was the first tape I ever had, and that song made me want to be a songwriter. And there was tremendous foreshadowing in my connection to the song. And then, you know, jump ahead all these years, I'm sitting in a restaurant with the filmmakers, and out of the blue, Todd Quaid says, you know, there's a song I've always pictured you singing, Pack Up Your Sorrows. And I just got chills. I couldn't believe that he had intuited this song. And we just pretty much decided on the spot, we need to call the film Pack Up Your Sorrows. And we closed the film with a scene of me singing the song. And it was a really beautiful moment. We knew right away that's our title. And the chorus, you know, if somehow you could pack up your sorrows and give them all to me, you would lose them. I know how to use them. Give them all to me. That's the essence, I think, of a story, which is one of transformation and how can we alleviate more suffering.
No doubt. So since you're kind of well-versed in statistics, you know, there's a huge gamut of mental illness. But how much of that would you say is actually depression as part of, you know, what's going on in the United States at this point?
Very important question. And I think we explore that to some extent in the film, really asking the question of how do we slow down? How do we get back to nature? How do we meditate? How do we do these things that make it easier to be a human being in a very fast-paced and fragmented culture?
And one that's not supportive at all of the human spirit.
Pardon?
And one that's not supportive of all of the human spirit.
No, no, not at all. We've lost all of that stillness that heals us. And there's no question in my mind that instability, that fragmented lifestyle, is triggering a much, you know, higher rate of mental illness. And I think we can change that if we start to do things like Burton High School in San Francisco, that's teaching meditation to all their students on a daily basis. We got to interview them, and that's the kind of foundation we can give young people that will help them. We'll give them, you know, mental, emotional literacy that can help them navigate and sometimes prevent these illnesses from being triggered. So it's, you know, it's very hard. I asked a leading geneticist at Harvard in the film, you know, how much of this is nature, how much is nurture? And he really said, you know, it's both. You can't untangle them, but we're working to figure it out. He said, you know, the way, you know, our nurture impacts how our genes get expressed, and our gene expression, of course, impacts our decisions and our environment, and it's very much connected. But I think what we have to definitely, you know, remember is that these illnesses have a very biological component. And if we acknowledge that, we take the blame away. And then we can also say, hey, you know, meditation can change the brain. And that should be a hugely empowering message that the illnesses are not our fault, but we have a lot of tools. We have medication, we have meditation, we have yoga, we have art, we have all of these resources, and we need to treat the whole human being in order to heal.
So I love the message. Love, love, love the message, Meg. So in now, I know that you're going to be, I mean, when that was put up on Facebook, and I love Facebook for such things because you don't, you know, you don't talk to everybody, but all of a sudden you see someone's like, oh, my God, that somebody needs to say something about that, needs to be promoted. So in the, I know that you did your original launch premiere back east in Massachusetts where you live, and you're having a showing this Saturday in Chico, California. Where else is your movie going to be shown?
So we'll be doing both the festival circuit and premieres in the major cities, especially areas where we interviewed people. So that will include eventually D.C., Madison, the Twin Cities. We'll be in Ohio this fall at a film festival, possibly in Colorado this fall, and we'll be in Memphis. Really all over the place, and then of course eventually the film will be available for, you know, streaming and on DVD. But we have our San Francisco premiere this coming Friday, and then of course the Chico premiere, which is very meaningful because that's where my father's family is from, and it's a wonderful way to celebrate that and to celebrate my uncle who's we lost this April to suicide, and it is his birthday on the 22nd. And this is the uncle who sent me my first guitar as a kid and someone who I had a deep, deep bond with. And he was always incredibly supportive and proud of my advocacy work. So the film is dedicated to him. And this is a way that we can celebrate him and bring the mental health community together in Chico to really send this message of, you know, let's take all the shame out of this. Let's take the shame away from talking about suicide. Let's allow families to feel the support that they deserve when they've lost someone. And let's just make this an open conversation, a safe space for people. And that's the way we're trying to transform that loss. And I know we're making him very proud.
Nice. Okay, so we didn't talk about where people can go to get your music and where people can go to get your poetry book.
So it's all available through my website, which is just MegHutchinson.com. And, you know,
okay,
iTunes and Amazon.
I'll put that
on
my Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page. So MegHutchinson.com. Okay, and then can people download this, download your movie, Meg?
Eventually it'll be available for our individual download, but first we want to do these premieres in the festival circuit. So that'll be a little ways off, but what they can do is sign up for the newsletter on our film website, which is packupyoursorrowsfilm.com. And if they're on the newsletter, they'll get an update when those release dates happen, and they'll be able to see what cities we're going to be screening it in.
Okay, that's great. Best of luck with that, and if all goes well, I'm actually going to be at that premiere in Chico. I've got to go to the coast, but if I make it back, I absolutely want to come and see that and see you, meet you. So you'll be there at your show, right?
Absolutely, yes.
And then are you going to have like a follow-up kind of conversation with people about processing whatever emotions or whatever? What comes after that for people when they've watched your movie?
Absolutely. We've followed every premiere with a Q&A and really letting the audience members ask questions and creating a safe place for us to talk about these issues. And we've just been amazed by the outpouring of, you know, people are so grateful to have a forum to talk about these things. And you really see how much people are battling this alone out of fear of judgment. And when, you know, we're just struck by when the last credits roll, you know, people are just so ready to talk about what they've been through or what they've seen a loved one go through. And it really makes it clear to me that no life goes untouched in some way by these illnesses, whether it's a family member, loved one, or whether we ourselves are dealing with some. You know, everybody knows somebody, and there's such a need for these conversations to happen. And we'll also have some mental health organizations there with tables and information for people, like the local NAMI chapter. And so we'll have resources for people who want to take away more information and get support.
And NAMI is the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. So, Meg, it's been an absolute pleasure. I wish you the best, and thanks for being another transformational voice on the planet.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
So I hope you've enjoyed this segment of Living Life on Purpose and an extraordinary voice helping the world kind of deal with its suffering and sorrow in a really creative way. And on Monday, I'm going to be doing a nonfiction author showcase series of interviews. So I hope that you'll join me. And if you happen to be in the Chico area, definitely come out and see this screening of Pack Up Your Sorrows and get on Meg's list. And I'll post everything on the Living Well Talk Radio Network Facebook page so that you can find all that and track all that. So thanks again, and we'll see you again on Monday. I hope you've enjoyed the show today. Enjoy all of the quality programs and archives we offer on the Living Well Talk Radio Network. I look forward to having you back with me again next week. And in the meantime, remember, be inspired for life.